Thanks. So, welcome. This topic is something I've wanted to work on for many, many years. And the first 10 or so years I wanted to work on it, I wasn't able to do it mentally. And then the second 10 or so years I wanted to work on it, I wasn't able to do it emotionally because of what it would take to, I could say, break the mold a little bit. But I'm getting old enough that I don't care. So breaking the mold simply means that there's certain understandings of Rudolf Steiner's work that are really, really useful if you want to work with agriculture. They're very, very subtle and difficult to understand. And one of the key pictures that he works out of is what's known as the etheric forces. There's a lot of controversy and background and conflicting viewpoints and misperceptions and strange beliefs around what we could call the etheric forces, both in regular science and in biodynamic circles. So that's why I never wanted to wade into this, because if you wade into this, automatically you're wrong. So automatically I'm wrong. So that's a given. That's a kind of my disclaimer. Automatically I'm wrong. So if you think I'm wrong, you're right. But what I would like to do with you is share with you the fruits of 30 years of doing this kind of work in nature, of how to experience the etheric, or what Rudolf Steiner calls the elemental beings that stand behind the etheric world, how to experience that in yourself, so that you have a feeling when you work with natural phenomena that you are in contact with spiritual entities. It's really important to have that feeling. Otherwise, the experience we have of nature becomes increasingly abstract. And we're in a space now where abstract thinking, even in biodynamics, is threatening to not allow the biodynamic work to grow in directions that it needs to grow in. That's a personal opinion, and I'm wrong. But it is my personal opinion in talking with many people and traveling to many places and now working with wineries and seeing how biodynamics interacts with their operation, we could say, how their operation as a money-making activity based on science interacts with some of the concepts in biodynamics. There's a kind of sound you can hear when that happens. It goes crunch. That what they would get, what the wineries would get from Davis as things to do, the things you have to do, meets the things you need to do in biodynamics head on with a kind of crunching sound. It doesn't have to, but it does. I've seen it. I've talked to the growers and spent time with them, and they all say the same thing. It's a very difficult thing to show why a bloody cow head in the back of your pickup truck means something beautiful. And you, if you know what I'm speaking about, you know what the issues are. That's a very difficult thing to tell people who simply want recipes. They just want the recipe, they do the recipe, they don't have to worry, and if there's a problem, they call the county agent. Okay, it's a guarantee, it's like an insurance policy. But Rudolf Steiner in biodynamics was not selling insurance. He was not giving recipes, in my opinion. He was placing principles for future research. He was giving us brilliant research parameters, brilliant, that have a deep tradition in the alchemical work and even back through the mystery schools, how one would interact with nature with a heightened consciousness. Because the key for the natural world is the human consciousness. The human consciousness is the fifth element. It's known as akasha. And without akasha, nature is simply chaos. But when humans interact with nature, the laws change. Human interaction with nature creates potentials that go beyond the natural world. This is just medicine. If you get a medicine made from, or a tincture made from an herbal product, you will not find that tincture in nature. It's not part of nature. It's part of an interaction between a human consciousness and the natural world. And that changes the what that substance is. It changes how it acts. It makes it, we could say, unnatural. And this is a difficult thing to get your head around if you are a nature person. But when you go out and plow your field, that's not natural. And if you keep plowing it the wrong way, you find out why it's not natural. Then you have to have the agent come in and tell you, oh, go this way, don't go that way. Yeah, so that quality of consciousness stands behind the agriculture course. And that quality could be called agricultural imagination. And agricultural imagination hinges on an inner experience. And the inner experience is what could be called the new participatory consciousness. The old participatory consciousness was where the gods and goddesses and devas and elemental beings that lived in the world made you do things. Unless you sacrifice chickens. And it was driven by a kind of fear of the unknown of the natural world. We could call that original participatory consciousness. It was your participation was to placate beings in nature who could wreak havoc on your life. And then came what we could call empirical consciousness, or the consciousness of the observer, which found that there were certain laws that could be used, scientific laws, to manipulate nature to overcome the threat of crop loss, of pest invasion, of plagues, you know, locusts, plagues, bugs. We could overcome them with drop dead twice, you know, DDT. So DDT is definitely unnatural. And it creates patterns in the natural world where the observer can do things and then watch what happens. And that eventually led to formulas and practices that ended up being NPK fertilizer. Yeah. Oh, if we just heat chicken manure in a barrel and the fumes come off from the chicken manure, we get some crystals that form in the top of the 50-gallon barrel. If we scrape them off, that's called urea. If you buy a package of NPK, that's the N. And so that, when it was found that if we could do that, we could take from the manure just the nitrogen component that caused an explosive growth and made the water drive happen. And we could put that in water and put it on a plant, and the plant would give the appearance of rapid water uptake and growth. That's the process that we go through when we make NPK. And it is a kind of alchemical, chemical process that has become codified into a formula. And we lose sight of the fact that in the manure, in the soil, in the plant, and even in the nitrogen, there are beings. There is a consciousness of the beings of nitrogen. And they have access to, humans have access to those beings through the nitrogen in their own bodies. This in the ancient world was the principle, by the way, you would learn how to placate the angry deities. You had things in you that could, and you could take certain substances that could enhance your, the ability of your nitrogen to access the nitrogen beings, we could say. That, you know, code word for that is psilocybin or marijuana. Because it's the nitrogen in those substances that alters your consciousness. So that those rules, so to speak, reached a culmination in the empirical or critical analytical point of view of nature that is driving modern agriculture. And Rudolf Steiner brought to the table a whole other set of rules to move from observer consciousness into what the scholar Owen Barfield called the second participatory consciousness. And the second participatory consciousness is that I need to understand the rules of the observer consciousness, one, by understanding what happens when I observe something. I need to observe my observing. When I observe my observing, I enter into agricultural imagination. Eventually, I can change my consciousness that when I go in such a way that when I go into the natural world as a participatory observer rather than a spectator observer, my consciousness allows me to experience activities of forces as personalities, as qualities of beinghood. They have dimension to them. They are not simply formulaic. They are not simply just rote. They actually speak to me through pictures that arise in me that Rudolf Steiner calls imaginations. And we think in our culture, imagination is something fantastical, but he was speaking about a quality in a human that has been trained to weed out the fantastical in imaginative practice and find the laws of the forces. Those laws he calls elemental beings. Or elementary beings. The forces are elemental beings. The patterns of forces in the natural world Rudolf Steiner's word for them is elementals. The laws of the forces in the natural world, Rudolf Steiner's term for them, is elementary beings. So the consciousness of the observer to enter into the laws of the natural world as an imaginative participatory consciousness are the laws of the new seership. That's when the work in nature becomes the work of priests and priestesses. It becomes a sacred thing rather than simply the application of rules. Application of rules are okay. They allow you to have a kind of substrate, but they don't allow you to move into participatory consciousness. They simply allow you to apply what already is known. And participatory consciousness of the agricultural sphere yields for the person who does the work a perception of what Rudolf Steiner calls the agricultural individuality. The agricultural individuality is the combinations of forces and the laws that are present in the mineral structure on your piece of land, the climatological niche, the particular flora and fauna that live there and that you bring into that microstructure in order to make your living. They constitute a being that has a particular persona. It has a behavioral pattern. And that behavioral pattern is present in the way in which the forces flow through the land that you work with. And you can go onto another person's piece of land and you have an inner experience that something's different. The question is, can you bring what is different to consciousness? Or does it simply stay as a kind of general feeling? If you wish to bring it to consciousness, you can train yourself to do that. And that's what I would like to bring in this workshop, is how can you train yourself to see the macro in the micro? How can you train yourself to see the cosmic in the forces and how that manifests as substance? Is it possible to do that and still be following lines that are reasonable, that are logical, that make sense to a scientist who studies the laws and forces and is still in the observer consciousness? Because ultimately, if your piece of land starts to outproduce the locals, they're going to have questions. And when they have questions, it's really good to be able to make a bridge between what they're being told from the county and what you know from your experience directly through dealing with the presences that animate the piece of land that you work on. And in between is Rudolf Steiner's indications. But if you start with Rudolf Steiner's indications, it's just a he said, she said situation. Here's my guy says this, and Davis says this. But if it's you speaking directly out of your experience, that's different. It has a different something to it. So that's what I like to share with you. That's what the topic macro micro is, because that's the big picture in Steiner's work, is the agricultural individuality is a personality that is suspended between the cosmos, the laws of the cosmos, and the laws of the earth. And they are not directly applicable. That's the problem. There's flipping that happens. And the training in imagination is that I have to be able to participate in the flipping without wanting to fix the answer that I get immediately. So there are four qualities in training agricultural imagination. And on the board here, they are observe, represent, carry it into silence, and then record. And we're going to do exercises. We're just going to keep repeating those four through the day. I have about 80 pictures that I've gathered from science, everything from plane waves of light from Michelson-Morley experiments through humus formation and cation and anion ratios and stuff like that, to try to make sense of what could be called the form motif of the agricultural imagination. So when I go into nature and I want to try to do this work of the agricultural imagination, there is a law, and the law is that the form of the thing I see is a corpse of the activity of the forces that have created it. But hidden in the corpse is a key to my consciousness participating once again in the activity, even though the corpse is a corpse. My human consciousness can revivify the corpse through imaginative participation. And I create in myself an imagination of what's known as the becoming of the form. Everything that we could call it growth. We could call it life gesture. And the life gesture of a plant or an animal or a mineral has definite laws to it. And I can participate in those laws imaginatively by observing the form, then representing the form to myself inwardly as a picture, but a picture that moves, because I'm trying to make my consciousness participate in how the form came into being, rather than looking at it as a snapshot. If I look at a form, so for instance, look on, you got three handouts. And the first one has this kind of strange little bug-looking thing on it. That's number one. First one looks like this. It has this kind of vortex here, and then two. That's number one. So up in the upper left, there's a form. And if I look at that form, that's observing. I can observe it in such a way that I simply take a snapshot of it. So look at the form and then close your eyes and try to see, can I see the form inside my mind's eye? That'll be our first exercise. Okay, if you can't do that, then this is the agricultural equivalent of learning to play the clarinet. And the answer to it all is practice. So if it was difficult for you to form the picture that you just looked at, there is a place in your body somewhere where you can do that. I've done this with people for a long time, and I've had people swear that they couldn't do it until one day they touched that place and suddenly the picture sprang up full blown and they went, oh my God, I have an inner picture. If you can do it, it's hard to imagine how you can't do it. But if you can't do it, it's hard to imagine how you can. Because it's all based on imagination. So imagination has in it the word image. It means I can form an inner image. Forming an inner image is known as representation. So observing is I look out at the thing. And I go, oh, and I recognize it. Oh, there, that's a picture of something. I don't know what it is, but that's, I can see that thing there. Representation is that I take the picture inside and try and represent it or re-present it. I re-present the picture to my mind's eye. This is the basis of imagination. Now, if I want to do a representation simply of a, I look at a circle, I try to imagine a circle. What happens if, let's do that. Let's say, look at that one circle at the top, one, two, three, fourth picture over number, figure number four. Look at it, it's a circle. And then close your eyes and try to hold the circle in your mind's eye. Okay, raise your hand if you still have a circle going on. Okay, about 10 people. Because what happens is, as soon as you try to hold the circle, your life forces say, I think you got a circle stuck in your head, man. Let's move that along. That's what Rudolf Steiner calls the action of the ether body. So when you try to hold on to a picture, you're actually working against certain life forces that want to keep that picture moving. And thank goodness they keep the picture moving, because if they didn't keep the picture moving, you'd have in your head every picture you ever looked at, everything you ever saw. Ooh, not a good thing. So you have in you a force that does not want you to be able to hold a picture in order that you stay healthy. But when you want to enter into a picture, the ability of the life body to dissolve a picture is a key. All the life body wants to do is move it. So if you take the inner picture and you represent it as a sequence of pictures, rather than trying to hold on to a snapshot, the life body is happy and you are in control. That's a very big deal. Your life body is happy because you're moving it, but you are the one who determines how it moves. That's called representation. So if I want to do that with, let's say, take picture number one on the figure one on page one up in the left, that strange looking thing. I can imagine how it would feel if I started at that dark little space on the left and then expanded something and then moved it out to a little point. I can take my fingers, just take your fingers, squeeze on the left, and then expand them as if you're sculpting in air. And then do that a couple times. Squeeze and lift and then flow and expand. Do it until your life body starts to be able to give you a picture. You're training your life forces. Basically, it's like trying to get and the attention of a cow. It's like you have to kind of repeat things a couple times, you know? Your life body is like a cow. It just says, just live. Just live. So I train it by inwardly trying to duplicate the movement that I would have to make if I made that picture. I could make a little sound. If you're audio rather than video, you can do it that way. And that's also an imagination. And it doesn't mean you actually have to see a picture, but it means you have to have the feeling as if you're touching the picture. Many of you work in agriculture. You may be tactile learners. Okay, so get your hands involved in it. Get two sticks and draw it in the dirt. And your life body will go, oh, okay, you're making something that looks like this. You're training your imagination to participate in the form. The key is that the form holds the key to the elemental and elementary beings. The form of the thing is their signature of how they come into being and how they go away. Whether it's a plant or a kidney or a bladder or a mesentery, the form is a key to the force. The form is a picture of the force. And if you learn to work with form imaginatively, and you begin to participate in the things you normally do, suddenly the things you normally do start to speak to you about other kinds of potentials. Rudolf Steiner calls that the elemental world. You don't see little guys with funny hats and pointy shoes eating pineapple. But you start to have imaginations of what needs to happen in that particular area. Gardeners call it a green thumb. It simply means that your imagination has the ability to participate in the sets of forces that are in that particular area. You all know, you get a plant, somebody gets a plant, they give it to somebody, a month later it's kind of yellow. They bring it to you, a month later it's green. How's that happen? It's the quality of the imaginations that the person is carrying, that the plant is picking up, because it's living. And it is living imaginations. Its forces, its organs are pictures of the forces that it needs, of the particular areas in the cosmos that it receives the sunlight in a particular way, at a particular season, at a particular time, in a certain form that allow it to create substances that become then whatever that plant is useful for in the natural sphere. So forces that come from the cosmos, in Steiner's language, that create the form, the result in the finished form of the plant. So here we have an imagination on the left. We squeeze it, lift it up, spread it out, makes a sound or a picture, or it feels a certain way to you. That's another way to do it. Now look at figure two. And turn it sideways like that a little bit so you can look at it. You see, squeeze it, pick it up, move it down, goes out to a little point. Same form. Very similar form. That those forms, when they work that way, is called correspondence. So I have a formal correspondence between these two pictures. Picture number one is an image of the plasma envelope around the Earth that is generated by the solar wind, and how the solar wind distorts the electromagnetic spheres into a long tail that goes out thousands of miles in space off to the right. That's a picture of that little space in the middle there, where you go like this and it has that little chamber. That's a plasma chamber. That's where the aurora borealis forms. Okay, so that's a picture of something. And the picture number two is a copepod that's about so big, and it lives in the plankton. There's a gazillion of them on Earth. It's about that big. Macro, micro. Question is that the basis of something we could use for a new science? Or is that just a fantasy? And that's the big question. So when I begin to do this and I see correspondences, I can tell you, this is from personal experience, 30 years ago I wrote the Biodynamic Book of Moons, and I had been reading Goethe and doing these types of exercises, and one day I walked out in my garden in New Jersey. Maybe it was, in fact, it was New Jersey, I don't know, but and all the plants were kind of going wow, 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 like that. All the flowers were not just snapshots, they were all going whoop, whoop. Come think of it, might have been New Jersey. Things happen to you in New Jersey. Yeah. And I couldn't shut it off. And the reason is that I had kept doing exercises to perceive the form as a becoming, and suddenly I saw the form as a becoming. And all the plants were showing me how they grow. And it was a little freaky because I was used to them not showing me how they grow. So the whole question is, if you start to do this, can you also turn it off? If you can't turn it off, that's a problem. So in order to turn it off, you need to be able to be the one who's controlling the way the picture moves. Otherwise, the picture will just keep moving, and you then have difficulty going to bed. Because it's just, you know, the pictures come in whenever they decide to come in, and they don't know it's 2:00 in the morning, and there you are. You're just seeing this, kind of twisting stuff in your head all the time, and you're saying, oh, Lord, get me out of this, I'll never do it again. Remember that in the 60s? Yeah. So the upside of imagination is you have an active imagination, and the downside is you have an active imagination. You can kind of very easily make stuff up. And that creates a problem when some guy from the newspaper comes to your place and is interviewing you about the weird stuff you do with cow horns. And you start to make stuff up because the juice is rolling. And then it goes somewhere, and then you wish you hadn't made it up. Okay, so I'm trying to show you there's this imagination is what Rudolf Steiner calls exact imagination. It's not fantasy. So simply for the fact that a copepod and the magnetosphere of the Earth in interaction with the solar wind have the same form does not mean that they are connected directly. It just means they have a similar form. If I want to find how that form operates, I have to move through, observe, and represent to silence. And silence means I keep repeating the representation and then dissolving it. I form it, I move it, I dissolve it. I form it, I move it, I dissolve it. And you make a practice of forming and moving the sequences of pictures. I form it, I move it, I dissolve it. The dissolving it moves the picture into silence. When I move the picture into silence, the beings who stand behind the forces approach me because I have now shown an active interest in how they live their life. I am paying respect to the elemental beings who are guiding the manifestation of the form. And I do that as a human by becoming silent. They recognize that a totally conscious, silent human is a very rare thing. Especially since I just went into silence honoring their work. They're very attracted to that. And they come and they enter into the silent space and say, you know, that's cool, but man, it's a little more like this. A little more like this. It's kind of, put this in next time. Try this. And that try this comes in total silence. You don't know it. If you know it and a little voice says, try this, then that's not it. Or if suddenly the heavens open and the trumpets blow and the angels come down and go, try this. Well, I'd try another channel. Personally. But if you have the right heart and you form the picture and you're really interested in how that is moving and you take it to silence, in the silence of letting go of the picture, there is something that comes to you. It's just the law of reciprocation, how the macro and the micro interact with each other. Every action I do to push something out creates an opposite and equal reaction to let something in. So every time I form and release a picture of something in the natural world, something is released and formed in my consciousness. And what I want to do with that is I want to record that. I make a sketch, I make a picture, I Google whatever. I write something out, even words that are like kind of wacky, just write it out. But don't determine that what you write out or the picture that you get is the answer. Because it's not the answer, it's just the beginning of the answer. And in order to get the answer, we need to just keep repeating it, adding something on the next day or next couple hours. I do it again or however. And I make a practice of the forming and dissolving and recording. And over time, what starts to emerge in my consciousness is an intuition of what I could do to deal with that thing. Or how I can use that entity, how I can use that substance or that plant or that animal or that mineral. Pictures start to come over time of how they correspond. And when that starts to happen, Google that and you'll find amazing correspondences. You'll find incredible correspondences because science has produced through observation a wealth of factoids that need a cosmology. Without the cosmology that we actually live among beings who animate the natural world, we just have a sea of factoids that form databases that are not integrated except into experimental analytical protocols. And if you get underneath all of these things, and we'll go here, we'll look at Einstein a little later in the second thing, what Einstein said about the etheric, and what everybody said about what Einstein said about the etheric, and what everybody forgot about what Einstein said about the etheric. But if you do this type of inner work, you'll be led to insights that can dovetail into the findings of natural science. You'll find certain substances that are used for particular things, and you've already had an imagination that this plant does that, and maybe you'll find a connection between a gem and one of the BD preps, or between a particular mineral and a plant, and then you find out that the organ in the animal actually is a specialist at rendering pH in the animal, and then that affects this substance over here. There's just a million things that can be found out from science that don't have a cosmology. And what Rudolf Steiner provided was the fact that it's possible to have a cosmology in the new participatory consciousness that allows us to once again see the elemental world, but in a precise way, not in the old way where I just do things because I'm freaked out. When you get freaked out, the sheaths of your body get loosened and you start to see all kinds of things in the world, and then you need people to tell you what it is that you are seeing. Then that becomes a tradition. When you go to this spot, this is the being you're going to see, and this is what they're going to say. That's the old way. So the new way is that you yourself take up your own imagination and try to enter into the natural world in such a way that it starts to speak to you, to you, about your place that you're working. Then the agricultural individuality becomes a reality rather than a concept. You shake hands with it. It's a being that you get to know, but you don't have to put chickens out with their heads chopped off in order to placate that being, because that being is an archangel. Of all the forces that are present where you live, including yours, including your consciousness. Okay, so that's my little preamble of what I think we can do with each other. So I'd like to do a lot of exercises with you with these pictures so that you get a feeling for this. And once we get a few things under our belt, I'm going to use these polarities up here to bracket the whole day. Here's the macro polarities are, this is like a language. So when Steiner speaks of macro, he calls them peripheral forces. Oh, I even forgot the big one. These are cosmic forces, and the micro are earthly. In Steiner's language, cosmic means macro. And the quality of macro forces are, they are all total potential. They are living. Macro forces are living. They have total potential. They operate at the periphery through the action of what he calls planes. And later we'll look at those planes. He's planes of light moving through space. And we go, well, that's weird. What do you mean planes of light? But that's exactly how science describes them. We'll look at that in detail. Okay, planes at the periphery, and the forces, the cosmic forces, are active in processes. Where one thing is changing to another, that's the action of light in the world, is to create the ferment to move things along. That's chlorophyll. It's just simply ways of receiving light. The substances in the plant receive light in order to become active. And that side of the equation, that's what we call cosmic force. Earthly forces are the micro side, and where macro is potential, the micro is manifest. It means this thing here. Macro works in planes, micro works with points. Centers stuff, manifest stuff. So macro is on the periphery, micro is in the center. Macro is process, micro is substance. Those are the great polarities. And he uses all of these terms in the agriculture course. He just kind of sprinkles them in. But I wanted to put them on the board so that you see he's speaking a kind of meta language that involves macro, micro all the time. His imaginations of the way in which he works with things is always trying to do this. That's the cosmology. His cosmology is that the macro and the micro are interacting with each other. The thing that makes them interact is consciousness. Whether it's a plant consciousness or an animal consciousness or a stone consciousness or a human consciousness or the elementals that live in your body, they have a consciousness of what's going on around you. And you can access that, but you have to do it coherently, systematically. Okay? So I'd like to read a couple quotes here from the agriculture course so that you can kind of put this in brackets. This is from the introduction, page 11 and 12 in the new edition. There's a big difference between dead nitrogen in the air and another kind of nitrogen. This kind of nitrogen must be formed under the influence of the entire heavens, the other kind. The living kind of nitrogen must be formed under the influence of the entire heavens. The living nitrogen must be alive. And you go, huh? I mean, alive. What he means is potential, not yet manifest as a substance. Alive. It's living. It's living. It's in potential. Everything that enters the body by way of digestive organs only provides materials to be deposited in what belongs to the nerve and sense system. By contrast, the substances we need for building up our bones and intestines and blood are absorbed from our whole environment by way of breathing and even via our sense organs. What comes from our surroundings insofar as it consists of, quote, framework substance and is pervaded by warmth and light, this is taken in by your senses. Framework substance. Framework substance is patterns of forces that will eventually yield a particular substance. It's the framework of something that will later manifest. And he uses that framework substances, that idea, in order to describe what could be called sheaths, or known colloquial as the sheaths of the preparations. So a sheath is a form, an energetic form in the natural world that attracts substances. A sheath is a framework that attracts substances to be deposited in a particular way. And that's, he describes them as being the actual source of a kind of the nerves. And by that he means consciousness. So that's why we use sheaths for preparations, because we want to give the substance that is encased in the sheath a consciousness. That's what he says all through there. Oh, well, this will enable the plant to pick out calcium out of this. Oh, what is that? That's a consciousness. So this language that he uses here is alchemical, and the polarities are always macro, micro, periphery, center, process, substance, life, death. A substance is something that has fallen out of life, but bears the signature of life. And that's really the big key. Forms have particular motifs, and the motif includes all kinds of feelings around how the form arises in us as a representation. And that experience is the part of you that can be trained. It can be developed to the point that when you just go out into nature and you look, you become aware of how those different elements in the landscape are affecting you. And that has a great deal to do with what Rudolf Steiner describes as the light coming into the senses. So we're going to do that with a sets of forms now. boom, 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 boom. We'll just go through. And then I'll ask you to observe, represent, go into silence, and then record things as we go along. Okay? So please look on first handout page again. Go to figure three. I'd like you to look at it and then imagine how this would grow. If you had to make this form grow, how would it grow? And move that inwardly, how it would grow. Then take it to silence. Go blank. Listen into the silence. And now for our record, just write anything. Just write an experience of how it would grow. Now, what we just did constitutes what's known as a thought experiment. And you just trained your imagination. You observe, you move it, take it to silence, and then record something. It's as simple as that. And if you wanted to get deeper into what this form was, you just repeat it. And repeat it, and somewhere along the line, the form would speak to you. You'd go out into nature, and you would see that form in a particular life form, and you would have an understanding. That's what I mean by speaking to you. The form, the activity you do inwardly in your consciousness would create a bridge between you and that form, that energetic form in the natural world. Okay, so look at the figure number four. And we're going to do the same thing. Observe. Represent it, grow it somehow. How would that form grow? Then take it into silence and then record something. Okay, figure five. And we're going to go up a notch a little bit here. This is a diagram from a very famous person, Nicholas of Cusa, known as Cusanus. He's a bishop in the Middle Ages, a geometrician, and a theologian who found this diagram, and it catapulted him into a whole other level of understanding what the divine was. It's a very famous diagram. The way it works is this. If you look at figure five, you see there's a circle. So put a dot in the center of this circle, and that'll be on that vertical line. Underneath the vertical line, put the letter A. Then there's a horizontal line where the circle meets the horizontal line. Over on the side, put B. Line B is the horizontal line. Line A is a vertical line. They cross each other at 90 degrees. The circle with its center on line A is touching where A and B cross. That's called tangent. The little circle is crossing where A and B, is touching where A and B cross. Everybody okay? So now look at the second largest circle and try to estimate where the center of that would be and put a point on line A, wherever that would be. Just kind of fudge it, doesn't. And then the third largest circle, even though it goes out of the diagram, see if you can put a point on line A that would be the center of that one. And that's okay to be an estimate. We're not building Rolls Royces here, so okay. Now the question is, if the first circle with its point and circumference is tangent to the crossing points, the second one with its center is also tangent, and the third one is also tangent to the crossing points, even though the circles are getting bigger. That's our protocol for the becoming of the thought experiment. Now, the thought experiment is that I'm going to keep making the circles larger by moving the center of the circles vertically on line A. That's our question. And when Nicholas of Cusa did that, it, in colloquial language, blew his mind, because he experienced something for the first time that let him understand one of the laws of the cosmos. I'd like you to do the experiment, the thought experiment of Nicholas of Cusa. Expand the circles by moving the center further and further up on line A until you move the center of the circle to the infinite. That's what he did. What happens to the circle? So this, you're going to move the center along line A up, and the circle will get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. When the center of the circle reaches the infinite, what happens to the circle? So observe, represent, go into silence, and record. Okay, so all three of these forms that we did, 3, 4, and 5, are related to this same idea of macro, micro. So what I'd like you to do is have a little conversation with a partner right now about what you discovered about these things. And when you have the conversation, listen to what they say about what they found, and see if inwardly something in you shifts. If it shifts, the quality of the shift, when it does shift, is the key to working with the elemental world. You have to be aware of when your prevalent, precious idea shifts. Because the elementals want us to kind of get it. And we go out there with whatever we think it is, and they're constantly going, we're going, not now, I'm busy. Right. I don't think you understand. This is the way it is. But it's probably we who do not understand what they're trying to tell us, because often what they're trying to tell us goes against what we think should be. So have a conversation with a partner. We'll do that for about 5 minutes, and then I'll call you back in. So this is interesting. Yeah, how this is. So these are related. The number picture number three, is known as a pointwise circle. Pointwise, because it grows out of a point and it expands linearly. Each point grows at the same rate out from a center. It's what we could call explosion. That's the picture. It's explosive. Centric growth comes from a center and moves out. But you would be surprised how little growth in the natural world works that way. You would be amazed to find out how little actually works that way. Even crystals don't grow that way, as we will find out as we go along. They all grow from the periphery. And so the forces in number four is known as a plane-wise circle. Plane-wise, as planes or lines coming in and out, growing, with planes moving out. And actually, there's an infinity of planes around that circle that make the points. If I had an infinity of planes, they all make where they all would all cross, we'd have an infinity of points. And those infinity of points could come from an infinity of lines that are coming from a center. Every center in nature has around it an infinity of planes. And yeah, that's a biggie. And And if you read about embryology or about cell division or stuff, very, very few things grow from their centers. They grow from the periphery. And so in figure five, figure five, Nicholas of Cusa found that if I expand a circle infinitely, where he did it actually with a sphere, if I expand a sphere infinitely, it becomes a plane at the infinite. Here we have a circle that's expanding. If I expand a circle at the infinite, it becomes a line. So we know that the Earth is round, but when you go to the ocean and look at the horizon, you see a flat line. And that's just the Earth, which is definitely not infinite. The question would be, if we went to Jupiter and looked at the horizon, would it be flatter than we see on Earth, or what? So there's a certain range that the human consciousness, when human consciousness encounters the sense world, at about 100 yards, science says, it experiences that everything, all light becomes parallel, and at the horizon, everything, every circle becomes a flat line, and every sphere becomes a plane. It's called collimated light. We'll go there also. Collimated light. At 100 yards, all light rays are considered to be parallel planes. And so we live in this, well, actually we could call a bubble of our own belief about the way the world is. And so I'd like to finish this first section here with just another look at the agriculture course. And this will be a segue to what we're going to do when we come back. We'll actually look at silica and the forces. The extent, this is from lecture two, the extent to which the soil itself becomes alive and develops its own chemistry depends primarily on the sandy component of the soil. Go to Davis and say that. Okay, so the soil itself becomes alive and develops its own chemistry depends on the sandy component of the soil. That is like he had too many betel nuts for breakfast when he did that. Okay. However, the conditions encountered by plant roots in the soil are greatly influenced by the extent to which the cosmic chemistry and the cosmic life are collected in the rock and stone. Light. It is through silica that the cosmic factor is absorbed by the earth and becomes effective. We should never forget that silica is indispensable for life. And then there's this beautiful quote from another section. The soil is a child of the sun. The soil is a child of the sun because it's the mineral content that takes up the life, the potential, the activity. And then it becomes organic. But it needs a mediator. The light needs a mediator. And we'll take a look at what that is in the next session.